That way we can, now Sam and I had a conversation, the sound wasn't good, so I decided not to share it. And well, let's talk about maybe what we'd like to come out of this conversation, because and that'll maybe help us figure out where we want to take it.
Sure. I think that it would probably be best if I repeated some amount of my backstory.
Okay.
So that people could understand the context. I'll maybe do it a little bit more briefly than the first time we talked.
Okay.
And then we can sort of pick up the conversation from where we left it last time.
Okay.
So I was born in a nice Christian household here in the Chicago suburbs. Grew up going to church. The church that I went to, and this is important for the story, was in many ways pretty much a standard evangelical Bible church in a lot of the ways that it operated, a lot of things that it taught. But in one, or well, there was a couple unique things, but the most important unique bit of theology that they disagreed with was with regards to the Trinity. We believed what's often called biblical Unitarianism, and that's quickly I would define it as only God the Father is God. All of God is God the Father. Jesus is the Son of God, but not God the Son. And the Holy Spirit is not a person, but God's empowering presence, or something like that. So that's a little bit different than the Trinity, but not, well, anyway.
If we're there and defining it a little bit, then because this gets complicated in terms of what is Jesus.
Yes. So Jesus is the Son of God, the Messiah. He was fully human, period. He died on the cross, was really dead, 3 days later rose again. I think the more interesting question is, what is Jesus now? But he's risen to the right hand of the Father. He's up there in the heavenly realm, and he's also somehow in all of our hearts simultaneously. So I guess that it is a fully man, or sometimes it gets dismissively called a mere man, Christology.
And I would think, when you think about the, if you were looking at the development of Trinitarian theology from a historical point of view, you begin the New Testament stories with everyone being, you know, the Jews around Jesus being monotheists. There is one God, and then right. Jesus comes along, and after Jesus and the events of Jesus' life, because you're a conservative in that you believe in full death on the cross, physical resurrection, ascension,
miracles, yeah, all
miracles,
that stuff.
So you buy all of those things.
Yeah.
And but the, you know, what happens with Jesus, it's always very curious at the end of the Gospel of Matthew. I love this verse because they worship Jesus and some doubt. It's a very compelling verse because here you have Jesus being worshipped, and of course you have Philippians 2, where you have this, you have the Christ song in Philippians 2. I don't necessarily want this video to get into an argument back and forth about the Trinity, but I'm asking questions in terms of trying to understand the teachings of the church you grew up in, especially with...
Sure.
Because right away, when it gets to Jesus and the relationship, I mean, when you say, okay, he's the Son of God, and in my Sunday school class, I've been kind of challenging the class on that, because as Christians now, people just say, well, he's the Son of God. I say, okay, well, Jared is the son of Paul. Is Jared to Paul, so Jared's one of my sons, is Jared to Paul what Jesus is to the Father? And you have to say, well, no, not exactly.
A little yes, a little no, right. So I should also clarify virgin birth and all that stuff too. But I think one of the main differences is, what was Jesus before he was born? And in standard Trinitarianism, he was the second person of the Trinity, co-eternal with the Father, begotten before all ages, those sort of things. But I don't understand him that way. I understand that he only existed in some sense in the foreknowledge of God. It wasn't like a self-conscious being sort of existence, but God the Father always knew what he would become and what role he would have to play. But in some sense, Jesus wakes up on his birthday and he's a new person, you know, without memories of what it was like hanging out in the pre-existent heavenly realm.
Is anything in the doctrine of this group, is there anything special about Jesus' baptism?
So there's honestly there's some diversity within biblical Unitarianism.
Surprise, surprise.
Some people would say, and this also connects with what some people thought in like the first, second, third centuries, that in some sense Jesus was anointed with the Holy Spirit and was anointed Messiah at his baptism. Some people would say, hey, kind of, but he was also sort of the Messiah as soon as he was born. But that would maybe be some difference in understanding of baptism. Something maybe changed about who Jesus was and what he could do at the baptism.
Okay. It's you know, so again, when I'm thinking about, well, I'm sure a Trinitarian debate will break out in the comments section. We'll give permission.
Yeah, I'm sure that will happen as well.
And I'm sure people will Google, you know, try and find out exactly what the specific teachings of this church are. And so, well, the focus, my goal of this conversation is not to debate the doctrine of the Trinity. My goal of this conversation is more along the lines of a lot of the videos that I've been doing to more explore the interplay of, let's say, belief. You know, there's propositional belief as such, of which members of a church will subscribe to the doctrine of the Trinity versus, let's say, believe in as in trust. So that's some of the interesting things that we've been working on. So you've got this, you grew up in this church that has, at least in the evangelical range of things, a rather unique take on the Trinity.
Sure.
And so you grow up in this church and there's a big evangelical world that you head out into and things happen.
Sure. And I also want to say, I don't want to just colonize your channel with biblical Unitarianism either. I feel like this brings up bigger and interesting questions that are more of what I want to dig into than just the particulars of the theology itself.
Okay.
So the church that I grew up in was small, and most people haven't heard of biblical Unitarianism because there aren't that many of us. So when I was growing up, I also went to youth group and sleepaway summer camp and those sorts of things in mainstream evangelical church. It's like I went to youth group at Willow Creek, which is about as mainstream of an evangelical church as it gets. The summer camp I went to was with Wheaton College, which is also about as mainstream as it gets. And so my parents told me, like, because my church was too small to really give the full suite of what it means to grow up Christian, they're like, you know, go there. We want you to go there. There's a lot for you to benefit from. Don't bring this up. If it comes up, smile, nod, and wait for the subject to change. Because if you talk about it, it will likely be more trouble than it's worth. So kind of an interesting side note on that is that my church did not view Trinitarians as damned heretics or anything like that. It was like, they're Christians too, maybe they're a little bit wrong, but they have some things that we don't, so you should go out into their world and benefit from them too. They might not see us the same way that we see them, kind of was implied in that. So let's see here. I'll skip forward to the college story a little bit because that's where this first sort of comes to a head. So I went to a secular university, and as soon as I got to campus, I joined a Christian fellowship. And again, it was one of the big mainstream evangelical fellowships that you would have heard of if I would mention its name. And my freshman year was great. I met a lot of good friends. It was kind of like the first time in my life that I had Christian friends. I went to, because my church was small, no one from my church went to my high school. So all of my friends were secular. Many of them were atheists, and I liked arguing with them. I think last time I mentioned I was kind of a de facto member of the communist club, even though I was like the token conservative who liked to argue with them. That's just kind of says more about my personality than anything else. So freshman year, you know, things are great. I changed my mind on a couple things. I don't want to give the impression that I'm just some sort of, you know, recreation of what I grew up believing. I also have some disagreements with where I came from. The hardest one was changing my mind on evolution, creationism stuff. And that was sort of a big thing that happened my freshman year. So sophomore year is when the action really started to get rolling. One of the leaders of a different Christian fellowship, not the one that I was in, came out as gay. He took a boyfriend, and he wanted his fellowship to affirm that in some sense. And that particular fellowship was associated with a denomination that had clear policies on this, so he was forced to step down from leadership. He was still allowed to attend, I believe, but just not to lead a Bible study or be the president or whatever his position happened to be. And for a couple months, only a handful of people knew about this. I was pretty well connected with the leaders of the other fellowships, so I knew about it. And then either he told some people or somehow it came out to the LGBT groups and to the student body government what had happened, and then suddenly like a firestorm happened. There was a huge protest at this Christian fellowship. I told you last time there was a couple hundred people protesting, but there's only 30 people attending the fellowship, so at least a 10-to-1 ratio on protesters to protesteds. There was, you know, raging editorials in the student newspaper and all those sort of things like you might expect. And so the student government was trying to push to have this particular fellowship kicked off campus, have their rights as a student organization removed from them.
They didn't they didn't own the privilege of their power differential, did they?
No. But there was stipulations in the bylaws or whatever that they were allowed to do this for religious freedom type reasons. So then the next move is like, well, let's just get rid of the religious freedom stipulations in the bylaws of the student government, and then we'll go after them.
And all those darn freedoms.
Right. And this was like in 2009. This was before kind of this more recent wave of campus uprising stuff. This was before social justice warrior would have been a word, before microaggressions were a thing, before woke would have meant anything. But it was sort of like an early version of that sort of phenomenon. And so they didn't end up passing a resolution because it was happening near the end of the school year. People then had to take finals. The person in question from that Christian fellowship graduated as a senior, and a lot of the members of the student government, I assume, graduated as seniors. So come back for my junior year, and most of the people have forgotten about the thing from last spring. But the Christian fellowships are shaking in their boots.
Yeah, they didn't forget.
They did not forget. And it was honestly, like, it was a little bit weird to feel like there wasn't anyone standing up for it. So there's this pressure of, you know, the student government, and like this is symbolic, you know, fights on campus are always symbolic. So the student government really represents what could happen at the federal government of the United States level. We're just practicing things now. And so what happened is that my particular Christian fellowship decided that they needed to draw tighter lines around who was in leadership. And so by junior year, I was the worship leader, I led a Bible study, and I was on the student leadership council. So I was in a couple different leadership positions. And so at the end of my junior year, the staff leader of my Christian fellowship says that, you know, let's have all of the leaders sign a statement of faith. And really, he wasn't doing it to fish out non-Trinitarians. He was doing it to sort of, you know, have some legal cover if something were to happen again.
Exactly.
And I totally get that. I totally understand that. But I was like, oh, well, what do I do? Because the statement of faith in its stipulations had, you know, normal Trinitarian language in it that I disagreed with. And of all the things I had changed my mind about over the 3 years that I'd been in college, this one had stuck for whatever reason. So I told him, I'm like, I can't sign this. But I still want to maintain leadership. And he was caught completely off guard. As you can imagine.
What? So, this is it? You'd have taken a boyfriend? That we'd expect, but the
right. You know. And the weird thing is like I said, I hadn't changed. I hadn't done anything, right? I was the same person before he asked me to sign this as I was afterwards. Right. Unlike in the other fellowship where the person had changed.
Right.
So it was a slightly parallel, but also slightly different situation. So he, in essence, asked me to, I couldn't be on the student leadership board anymore. My Bible study got disrecognized. Like, we still kept meeting. No one knew, in the Bible study except me, knew this. But I was still leading a Bible study that was just no longer associated with the Christian Fellowship in case things happened. And I wasn't, I was still the worship leader, but the worship leader was just no longer a leadership. So it was, what he was trying to do is he didn't want to cause another uprising. He didn't want to remind people of what had happened last fall and or last spring and get the Christian fellowships in trouble again. But he needed to follow the letter of the law. And here I'm just kind of caught in the middle. I don't want to bring any harm upon the Christian fellowship that I'm in. I like it. I support its mission and all those things. But now I'm in this weird spot where I'm kind of like a leader in practice, but not a leader by the letter of the law. So that was pretty hard for me. That summer was pretty hard. Later on in my senior year, I like went up to him and said, hey, this is just really confusing for me. I don't know if I'm in or out. I don't know what I can say and can't say. I don't know what I can do. Can we revisit this topic? And so he let the student leadership board vote on me, whether I could be reinstated into leadership or not. And everyone on the student leadership board is like my best friend or close. One of them's literally my roommate. And so they unanimously voted very quickly to keep me restricted from leadership. And so it's one thing to like get rejected by following the letter of the law, but it's very different to get rejected by your friend and to have their opinion of you just flip from trusted person to not trusted, possibly not a Christian person.
Now with respect to, so how did this change how they treated you?
Some of them, yes. So I should say some of my friends were really nice. They just didn't happen to be on the leadership board. Some of them stuck with me and were very understanding. Some tried to start evangelizing me again, which was sweet-hearted, but very strange when, like, previously, like, we had gone on mission trips together, and now all of a sudden they're, you know, evangelizing towards me to try and Trinitarianize me, something like that.
Did they find a, I'm kind of curious about what that evangelistic process looked like to re-Trinitarianize you. Just give you Athanasius and say, hey, buddy, what if you...
Gosh. Yeah,
my mind goes all kinds of different places. Some of which probably my mouth shouldn't go. but I mean, this is just such an interesting case study on so many levels.
Yeah, if Christianity had a Supreme Court, I should probably go to it.
Yes, and it's very interesting that part of your argument, this is also based somewhat on our last conversation. I mean, so what we seem to have is a very foundational area of Christian doctrine that in some ways seems non-functioning or non-visible to many, many people in the church. I mean, for years you have passed, and there's other stories of other churches you've been to. For years you easily pass in evangelical churches as one of their own, partly because nobody's looking at Trinitarian issues. Everybody's looking at culture war issues and theological and liturgical issues of the last 50 or 100 years, and Trinitarian issues of the last 1500 years, 1800 years. Nobody's paying any attention to those. And so in you go until, but what's fascinating to me is that the leadership committee of this group didn't say,
Sam. Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't say that. They said, wow, this is a big deal. That's evidence that there's still within the Christian community, no matter how sleepy and no matter how latent,
yeah,
a strong commitment to Trinitarian subscription, I'll say.
Right.
And so, of course, this for you becomes a very salient, if I'll use that word, this for you becomes a very salient issue, because now it does, in fact, become a very live issue for you in many relationships.
Right, right. Another weird part of this is when you grow up disagreeing with the majority consensus, you often understand the majority consensus better than the people who, subscribe to it.
Yep.
Because you have to have a lot of knowledge. And my church would talk about the not Trinity way more than normal churches would talk about the Trinity, because they know this is a huge pressure that the congregants will feel, and that they have to be well informed to know exactly why it is that they're disagreeing with 99% of Christians and even a larger percent of Christian history. So that's part of it. So a lot of times when I'm getting reverse evangelized, like if I just ask two or three questions deep and I can get them stumped. And that's not to say whether the Trinity is true or not based off of these people, but I would often know it way better than them. I would know all of the relevant verses, yay or nay, and all of that stuff. And so it would be weird to be getting pressure by sort of like the Trinity is important, but we kind of only can half articulate why. And I'm like, look, I see where you're coming from, but not really.
Disagree. This is your conviction. And you're bound by your conscience to not lie about your reading of the Bible.
Right, right. Here I stand, I can do no other. That's a little presumptuous.
Well, you're sitting too, so.
Yeah, it's strange, because I also am of two minds on this. I've thought about this so much that I have really strong opinion. But there's also the part of me that's like, but I see good Christians on both sides of it. Like, and not just like good people, but like good Christian, right? The people who, when they pray, it's like, man, they're really praying. When they sing, they mean it the way they live their lives, etc. Like, if there's a Turing test of who's a Christian and who isn't, they're passing it. But I know non-Trinitarians and Trinitarians that fit that definition. So to me, it's like, I have this huge, built up intellectual understanding of the topic that makes it seem really important. But when I look at everyday life and in the way Christians actually live out their faith, it's like, how important can it be? That's not like a conclusion that I necessarily want, although part of me wants it because I want to be let back into churches. But it just seems like I have a unique perspective because I'm fence-sitting on this. I can code switch back and forth. I can go from one kind to the other kind, and I'm unusual that way. There's not many biblical Unitarians who have spent so much time in Trinitarian land as I have. So it's sort of like, man, you guys are way more similar than you realize, except when you're arguing about this particular topic.
Well, and it's, I mean, part of what's interesting about this is that, well, there's so many interesting things to me about your story, because, you know, one of the big, so actually the realm that you had your fight in the student union was, I mean, this is essentially, in terms of the LGBT, the church's traditional stance on sexuality, this is the argument that is being made by the affirming side. They're saying that this is a thing indifferent. There's nothing foundational to Christianity about, you know, traditional sexuality, and therefore this ought not to be a boundary marker.
Right.
And there are lots of those. There are lots of similar arguments out there. Infant baptism, and in fact, there are. In the Christian Reformed Church, the Christian Reformed Church continues to hold a line. If you are a minister in the Christian Reformed Church, you can get in trouble if you, you know, start dedicating babies. You can dedicate a church van, you can dedicate a sanctuary, you can dedicate lots of things in the building, but you'd better not dedicate a baby, because you better baptize that baby. And, you know, so, and again, and I don't say that flippantly, because not just because I don't want to get in trouble, but because I also have some convictions about this. Babies are more significant than church fans or new rooms. But again, your situation just illuminates, and I think invites us into asking questions about belief and practice and structure and institutions and, you know, what it means to, you know, what it means to be a Christian, and what does Christian profession entail. It just yours is just such an interesting case to me, because it illuminates so many different topics.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit confusing to be the case itself.
Well, yeah, that's seldom fun to, fun to be the one who, so in a previous conversation, you talked a little bit about, you know, you get out of college, you get married. Are you married?
I am married, yes.
Okay, where's your wife on this?
So she grew up in a Lutheran church. She's from Wisconsin, so... no surprise there. She sort of became more evangelically inclined in college. So she has a purely Trinitarian background. I brought this up on, like, say, our fifth or sixth date or something like that. You know, it's not like a first date conversation, but you don't want to save it for too late either.
Fully yoked.
Right. So... I think she's a little bit perhaps agnostic. She's reticent to maybe change away from what she grew up on, but she hears where I'm coming from. And she also doesn't think that it should be a boundary marker issue either. So even if she is more Trinitarian than Unitarian, she doesn't think that it should be a red line marker between within and out.
Which... you know, you're married to her, so that's
So
then you get what were you married in a church?
We were married in a church.
In an evangelical church?
And then we met in a Bible study at an evangelical church that I won't name.
Did her parents get upset because that was supposed to be a fold full of pure
We'll say that we maybe haven't had this conversation with her parents yet.
They don't watch my channel, I suppose.
I'm presuming not. I mean, there's all of these tricky questions, and that's a good one. You know, when do you talk to your girlfriend about it? When do you talk to her parents? When do you talk to, you know, this is why I can never just drop this topic from my head, is just when I think that things are going fine, something else comes up that I didn't expect. And so we have a 1-year-old daughter. She's almost about to turn one. So I'm sure right now she can't talk, but I'm sure once she learns to talk, then that'll bring up all sorts of questions and issues in and of itself.
So then you're going to have to make a decision. Do I lead my daughter into this legacy?
Right. And this is honestly a curse I wouldn't wish upon an enemy, but at the same time, I'm just not the kind of person who can just give up on what they think. Like, my conscience just can't let me do that. I, in some sense, need to really feel like I'm actually believing it. I'm not just going to sign on a dotted line. Although I will say, I didn't mention in this last conversation, this conversation so far, but I'm honestly a little bit more agnostic on this than just pure 100% convinced. I would say that most of my trips are still in biblical Unitarian land. Some trips are in Arian land, you know, just in case I haven't freaked anyone out already. And Trinitarianism is maybe in third place, I guess, in my mind. And I can see the arguments for them, but at the same time, when I need to sign on the dotted line, I still agree with what I grew up with, more or less. So, yeah, just complicated decisions at every turn.
Still go to the Biblical Unitarian Church?
Honestly, it's kind of dissolved. The church that I grew up in doesn't really exist. It kind of does, but not in the way that I knew it growing up. It's just a remnant of what it used to be. It's not a viable church that I'd want to go to or take my family.
So are there individuals in the Chicagoland who are, you know, just sneaking into church, covering their mouths?
So this is really interesting. So I went to a Biblical Unitarian conference last weekend. So in between the last time that we talked. And there was about 300-400 people there. There's a couple denominations that have sort of simultaneously agreed to this sort of thing, and they have their disagreements on other topics, which is interesting, but they're like, man, we got to band together on this one.
That's right, they're them against the world.
Right. And a weird thing that happens is there's a lot of people who just come to this conclusion by themselves through the internet. Sure. A lot of them are 30-year-old males that are tech-oriented. Maybe you can relate to that phenomenon. And so I'm at this conference, and honestly, it was heartbreaking. I was talking to so many people whose stories are way worse than mine, because at least I grew up in the Unitarian Church and had a church. Some people lost their jobs because they were in ministry. Some people lost their families or had to get divorced, or, you know, just a lot of people have worse stories than me, and they do it just because this issue captures their attention. Although, one thing that was a little bit discouraging about this conference is that they, not everyone, but a lot of people have a lot of animosity towards Trinitarians, some for understandable reasons. But I'm like, no, this isn't where we should go. You know,
we're going to get crushed.
Yeah. And well, resentment is never a good thing to do anything for. But for me, I'm like, I think we need to demote this issue on the totem pole of priorities of how important it is in terms of statement of faith sort of things, or heretic, not heretic, heterodox, orthodox sort of things. So that would be the only conclusion that I can come to based off of my experience, is that this maybe isn't quite as important as most people think it is. But at this conference, they were going in that exact opposite direction. We need to make biblical Unitarianism the most important defining feature of our theological identity. I'm like, no, please not. That's the opposite of what I want to do. So it is strange. It's strange.
Well, there's so many interesting social and psychological dynamics at play in that, because, you know, I mean, those are the, you know, emphasize the difference, try to win the war, which quite frankly was lost a long time ago, probably. And, or just say, you know, and that's, and again, in terms of gay, you know, same-sex marriage questions in churches. You just watch the same, oh, it's something indifferent versus, you know, we need to promote this. And it's just so interesting. Now, gosh, you know, and again, back to, you know, where we started this, you know, one interesting, it fascinates me. So just from a purely questioning posture, it's like, well, you start tinkering with, I mean, part of the reason, so if you look at Christian history, when, let's imagine that moment that is referred to in the Gospel of Matthew, when they're all up on the mountain, and after the resurrection, and some people sort of go down and bow and start worshiping Jesus, and you know, everybody's been catechized in their monotheism, and so some people are looking at them worshiping and thinking, I understand that. And other people are like, nah, I ain't gonna go there. Okay, I understand that. And so, you know, obviously full-blown Trinitarianism and Christology just pop into people's minds. Over a long time in the church with lots of wrangling and discussion and philosophy and theology and looking at, you know, and bear in mind, all of this debate happened in a time before the printing press. And so there are likely bunches of people working off scripture in memory, bunches of people,
yeah,
different manuscripts that may have subtle differences in them. I mean, it's a...
And some people have big libraries and some people don't, you know.
That's right.
And bless you if you're in Alexandria, but if you're in the hinterlands of Turkey, you know, heaven help you, you know.
That's right. That's right. And eventually, over very long periods of time, you know, decades and hundreds of years, councils agree on certain formulations, which obviously have packed around them all sorts of, you know, philosophical language. You know, when I was just actually having a conversation on a Christian Reformed board, bulletin board, where a prominent CRC pastor is basically are asserting that many Christian Reformed churches have essentially departed from Calvin's understanding of the sacrament and have sort of slid into Zwinglian, you know, mere Zwinglian. And, but of course, then you've got pressures to, well, let's, you know, continue to work on a relationship with Rome. You know, what is really the difference between Calvin's real presence and, I mean, transubstantiation is, you know, I'd taken kind of a cheap shot at transubstantiation in one of my videos and got called right away in the comments. And someone said, listen to Bishop Barron's video on transubstantiation. I listened to it and I thought, yeah, that doesn't sound quite like the rather anti-Catholic messages I would get growing up in Christian Reformed schools. And
right. In
fact, transubstantiation has everything to do with distinctions between the substance. I mean, the substance changes, but the attributes don't change. So you could take this wafer and, you know, dissolve it chemically and find all the constituent elements of mere bread, but it is in fact the body of Christ. And you know, when I look at that, I think, yeah, I'm more happy with Calvin. Real, yeah, presence. But what do I mean by real?
I mean a lot of smart people spend a lot of time thinking this out, and don't, my opinion is that you can learn something from everyone. And there's also been church fathers who have believed this, that, and everything that you can possibly imagine. And before you discard them, you really have to understand them. And a lot of times they're way more sophisticated on the topic than you think they are.
Oh, well, that's right. So,
Christology to transubstantiation.
You know, heretical church fathers like Origen.
Right.
You know, it's
whose teachings are heretical, but who the person isn't, you know.
Somehow. Well, that's right. And so, I mean, people are enormously complex, and then we get into these, but yet, so that's one side of it. And on the other side of it, I mean, you've kind of adopted this adiaphora posture of, well, this is something that's rather indifferent, but you there are limits to that for you too, I assume.
Right. Well, like in the story from college, there, it didn't start out with the Trinitarian question. It started out with, can a Christian group define for themselves who they get to be, or does the overlord get to have rules about what a Christian group can and can't define themselves?
That's right.
And so that was the first question.
Yeah.
And then it's like, be very careful what you wish for when you that. So both of those things were happening at the same time, and that didn't slip my notice. So it's not that I don't think theology doesn't matter. I'm not saying that there should be no doctrines or something like that, like the other kind of Unitarians might say, the kind that people might be more familiar with. And, well, you know, there's an interesting parallel there for how they came to that conclusion. But so it's hard because I feel like if Unitarian churches have a weakness, their weakness is often an underappreciation for tradition. And one reason why I would say so many cult-like groups are non-Trinitarian, or why so many non-Trinitarians are cult-like, is because inside healthy denominations that have been around for a long time, deep in their DNA, both in practices that are, you know, overt and covert and liminal and subliminal, are practices that help prevent cult-likeness. Right? Like, if you wanted to embezzle money from your church, I bet there are some things that might make it difficult for you that your denomination has put in place.
That's
if you're exactly a brand right. new church and you don't have those rules, well, then there's fewer barriers to that sort of thing. And so a lot of non-Trinitarian denominations are like, man, we need to start from scratch. If that Trinity thing was wrong, then who knows what else is wrong? And, you know, blank slate, New Testament only, you know, that sort of thing. We need to just get back to what the first century church was like, and then we'll be fine. Just accept that the first century church was also a mess. But so a lot of that anger at, or distrust of tradition is what clears away all of those built up practices that a church has, that a denomination has, that prevents devolving into cult-likeness. And so I think that there is a real relationship between non-Trinitarianism and cult-likeness. It might not be because of the Trinity itself. It's often because of throwing out a lot of baby with some bathwater.
Now, for you, obviously, you're one person, so all this stuff comes together. But the conviction of this Unitarian posture for you is based on, in a very Protestant way, the Bible.
Yeah. Yes. So I've thought about this a lot, but at the end of the day, I feel like my conviction on this is because that's what I understand the Bible to teach.
Yeah,
and that's our obligation as Christians, to believe what it is that the Bible is teaching. So that brings up all sorts of questions of interpretation and how tradition can mix in with that, and how much we can really understand or even implement in the 21st century what it was that a Eastern Mediterranean Hellenized Jew thought. But that's the idea, is that needs to come from the Bible itself, and that we're a priesthood of all believers, that we can approach the Bible ourselves, and we need to do our own study, our own homework, and make up our own minds.
Well, in our first conversation, I mentioned Alistair McGrath's book entitled Heresy. He's got another book that I read a few years ago, which I thought was also very interesting, Luther's Dangerous Idea. And I just know in this conversation, we've got the Orthodox and the Roman Catholics saying, yeah,
told you so,
Protestants. See the trouble you caused? Come on back to the fold where you listen to the apostolically successive leaders of the church and the institution that provide for you the correct doctrine which the scripture supports. Whereas the Protestant move is that the scripture is the source But the interesting question in that move is, it's not just the scripture, it's the reader of the scripture. And so Luther, you know, Luther has his experience with the scripture, and Karlstad, you know, almost right next to Luther, disagrees. And so right there in Wittenberg, you have the beginnings of this fraying that, you know, has continued to fray.
I think it's a very interesting, first of all, Orthodox and Catholics out there, point taken. But I think that it's a very interesting and confusing question. Like, Luther was doing what he was doing because he thought it would be a way to unify the church, right? He thought that, man, if our goal, just understand this the way the original author meant to the original audience, that's an objective thing that we can do. And the text, if we share it, that's an objective thing. So if all of us do that and point in the same direction, we should all come together and be unified in the end. But for some reason, we have tens of thousands of denominations.
That's right.
And that's honestly a little bit of a mystery. I don't know exactly how to give an answer to that. That, like, a lot of Orthodox and Catholic interpretation is based off of more allegorical understandings of things, and that there is more layers than Protestants often have in their hermeneutic style. And you would think that, like, a criticism would seem to be, well, you can insert a lot of your own biases into an allegorical interpretation of something. So it seems if you let allegorical interpretation rule the day, then everyone's going to be off in their own place. Where if you have the objective, let's all come back to the original authorial intent sort of thing, that should unify us. But the weird thing is, it seems to be the other way around. Yeah. If you have a thick tradition with all sorts of allegorical stuff in it, that seems to be able to unite a church for thousands of years. Yeah. But when you have everyone trying to make up their own mind, you end up with, you know, a different kind of church on every corner.
Yeah. Although at the same time, I don't know where the church would be today if not for the Protestant Reformation.
I agree with that too.
You know, it's you know, and Luther, you know, I just read that book with about Luther and Erasmus. I mean, you can take another step back, and I mean, so Erasmus, so you have the development of the printing press, and Erasmus is beginning to notice, you know, oh gosh, more people are learning Hebrew. People are learning Greek. Printing presses, a few of these presses now have Greek type. We can lay out the Vulgate, and oh my, look at all of these different manuscripts that all these monasteries and churches have. And I'm looking at two of them, and they're not the same. So, and so then some in the church want to say, well, Jerome's Vulgate is the real Bible, kind of like some little church somewhere in the American frontier will say, the King James is the real Bible. And Erasmus says, well, shouldn't we maybe look at these texts? And some of these translations by Jerome from the Greek into the Latin, they really don't cut it. So, you know,
and some whole passages that are in there have seemingly no manuscript support.
Exactly.
Like the Johannine Coma, which I, you know, looked that up on Wikipedia. Unitarians like to point that one out. But,
well, that's right. So once you begin working this stuff through, it's like, oh. And then you see, like, in the Roman Catholic tradition, which I know better than the Eastern tradition in terms of their fights, well, now you've got the Jesuits and the Dominicans and, you know, these different orders within the church. Well, they're fighting like Protestants and Catholics. And so, I want to keep in mind the, you know, this is, so it's often tempting. It's often tempting at this point in a conversation for people to sort of throw up their hands and say, well, we can't know, and nobody knows, and who can know? And I sometimes bring up the illustration of the 2008 financial collapse, because someone would say, well, everybody kind of saw it as a bubble, but who can know? Well, actually, there were some people who knew, And right. they bet on it. You know, if you watch, what is it, The Big Short, that movie?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I mean, this dude, he knew, and he bet on it, and he was and right.
Billions of dollars, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So, right. so I, you know, it's tempting, especially for Americans, to just kind of throw up their hands and say, nobody can know. And I'm not willing to go there either, because that's just as definitive as some other moves. So I think it's, I think we're better off continuing the conversation and continuing to look at this stuff. You know, I had a conversation with Nathan Jacobs, and
I love that conversation, by the way. I think I've listened to it two or three times. One of the clearest explanations of that, you know, fourth, fifth century church history stuff that I've heard.
Yeah. And so when you find someone who really, you know, to know more than me isn't necessarily that much. So, because as you say, I mean, so everybody's in these biblical Unitarian churches, they all are paying attention to these details while all the other Christians are out there talking about who knows what else. So yeah. when you find people who know a lot of this stuff, but then you get the question of, okay, so you've got a tiny little number of people who really looked at this carefully. And then what happens, obviously, in a church tradition is that the church comes to an agreement on something, and that agreement holds. And sometimes that agreement holds for centuries. And in fact, many agreements in the Roman Catholic Church held for centuries until the Protestant Reformation. And then, you know.
Right, right.
Oh, wow. And practices, and then the relationship again between a formal creed and a practice, because you could say, wow, these non-Trinitarians, these biblical universalists or biblical Unitarians, it's different than universalists, these biblical Unitarians are, you know, looking awful. They're indistinguishable from Trinitarian evangelicals, but then you always have the difficult questions that we live these tiny little lives. And this is, I think, part of Alistair McGrath's argument in his book on heresy. The combination of tiny little lives over successive generations, a thing that looks insignificant in one person might become very significant hundreds or even thousands of years later if part of the DNA of a tradition. And the right. argument of Alistair McGrath in that tradition is similar to the point you took from the Orthodox and Catholics, even though they're not together either, which is that part of what Alistair McGrath poses with respect to heresy is that what heresies are ideas that over the very long term are unstable for a theological body and for the community that's in relationship with it. And yeah. it's kind of a Darwinian, an idea Darwinian scheme that over the very long run, the better, truer positions will out.
And it also brings up the possibility that something might be right for reasons that are beyond our understanding.
Yep.
Right? Yep. Like, and that it's an argument, and well, the tradition says it, and we're still around. Don't know why, and we can't maybe give a knockdown proof for it, but that might not necessarily mean it's not true.
Right.
So, but there, I see that, but there's part of that that kind of bugs me. It's like, so where does individual reason fit into that? Yeah. And where, how do those two things, how does the, you know, the multi-generational lineage selection fit in with an individual life?
Yeah. Well, and think about that. You know, one of the interesting tidbits I picked up in the last few years, if you read the book 1493 and other books written recently, basically assert that African slavery in the Americas is likely the result of greater resistance to malaria, which was also brought over, than anything else, because it was in the best interest of Virginians to use Northern European indentured servants. They just kept dying of malaria, whereas individuals from West Africa who had resistance to malaria inside of them. Now, again, you're talking at a time when nobody knew anything about malaria.
Or sickle cell anemia or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And sickle cell anemia is interesting because that's kind of the opposite side of it, because right. their resistance to malaria is paired with their susceptibility to sickle cell anemia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then
genetic diseases are like that, where they're a defense against something even worse.
That's right. And whereas in one generation it might not seem to make a difference, but if you imagine, as Christians do of a church, that this is in a sense, a body that lives for, I mean, just look at the language, a body that lives for thousands of years, well, then maybe that piece of its genetic code is important in a way that one tiny group of people won't see. And I think we've got elements of that going on in many interesting, very lively church conflicts today, one of which being, you know, men or women in women priests, women in church leadership, sexual morality in the church, infant versus believer baptism. And I mean, because churches
are machines and worship.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't usually wear a suit and tie here, but I won't wear shorts and lead worship in shorts. And it's like, why? I don't know. It just doesn't feel right. So just over the line. I don't preach in jeans either. So it's like, okay, jeans versus Dockers or, you know, slacks. Why? Well, I'm just not, you know. So we're mysteries to ourselves. So.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, again, your case to me is so interesting, and it will be interesting to see. So you might say a little bit, I don't know if you want to or not, a little bit about the situation with your current church.
Sure. So after I graduated, like you said, got a job, moved around, went to grad school, got married, a couple years in there, and a lot of, during those years, I was often going to evangelical churches that were Trinitarian and not doing anything where I would have to sign a statement of faith. And often I knew I'd only be there a couple years anyway. So, you know, made some friends and it was worth doing, but I just kind of stayed enough in the background to not bring it up. So now, you know, my wife and I get married. We move back to the Chicago suburbs and are planning to be here for as long as we can foresee. And so we are kind of searching for now this church might be more for real. So we're going to a church. We've been there about a year and a half, and they asked for volunteers for the worship band. I'm like, oh man, I haven't done that in a while. How about I volunteer for the worship band? And that led to a cascade of events where I was meeting with the head pastor. And so the head pastor's like, so I hear you have some disagreements with our theology. And I told him the story. And he was like, huh.
his reaction was like mine. It's like, oh, this is interesting.
although he might not have been
problematic. You're not in my church. If you joined my church, everybody would be like, oh, you got musical skills? Great. He's not a Trinitarian. We want him to play music, but sign the covenant of office bearers.
Right. Right. And so it was with him and an elder, and they're like, we need to think about this. This is a new thing. So him and the elder board met to discuss me. And then I met with the head pastor again, 2-3 months later. And so I thought that they were going to come back at me and say, look, we view the worship band as kind of a highly visible function. But we always need help setting up and tearing down the equipment or operating the soundboard or whatever. So if you could please do that, please understand. That was the conversation that I was expecting. And so after some kind of friendly, you know, banter, he asked me, so have you been taking communion? And that was when I was like, oh no, I see where this is going now. And I said, well, yes, I have. He says, why? Or something like that. I'm like, when you offer communion, you say, if you believe in Jesus, you're welcome at this table. So I was doing that. And so he's like, well, we're going to have to stop. We're going to have to ask you to stop taking communion. And that just caught me completely off guard to get literally excommunicated. In case you didn't know what that actually meant out there on the internet, that's what that means. Excommunicated. And so I was like, you know, that seems unnecessarily harsh. You know, what's the reasoning behind that? And, you know, I don't even remember what he said. But he was like, well, some people on the elder board wanted to label you as a false teacher, which meant that we wouldn't let you in the church at all. But we're still saying that you can come. And I can see why he thought that that was a nice thing to say. But the conversation that they were having was, let him in the front door, yes or no. Communion, obviously not. Whereas I thought they were thinking, sound the board, you know, yes or no, or playing the guitar but not singing yes or no. So me and my wife had to leave that church. And that was kind of hard on my wife, because that was the first time this had ever really reared its head for her. And like I said, she's maybe still a little on the fence on this. She feels a little bit like she's getting thrown under the bus for my sins. Is that the right word? I don't even know. And so
theological deficiencies.
My theological deficiencies. And so we left that church. And that was hard because, you know, like, church for us is very important. We met in church. A lot of our friends were in that church. And it's really kind of embarrassing to have that happen. You, like, I don't know what they say about me or what the official story that got circulated around, but I'm sure it's not the version of the story that I would tell. And so knowing that there's people who you used to care about or who you still do care about thinking who knows about you, and that was even harder on my wife. I have thicker skin on this subject because I've been through this before. And so we went to a different church of the exact same denomination, and that is even sometimes partners with the other church. But the big difference was I knew this pastor ahead of time because we're back in the area where I grew up again. And so my dad had known this pastor. I'd been on a mission trip with this pastor. So he knew the whole backstory. So I met with him before we go there and was like, look, it reminds you of the deal. You probably remember all of this. Would I be welcome in your church? And he said, yes, absolutely. Could I take communion? Yes, absolutely. And how about I meet with you once a month to discuss theology together? And I'm always up for discussing theology. I'll discuss theology with anyone. So we've been going there and things have been fine. And the pastor's just so nice. He, like, every Sunday, like, I just want you to feel welcome here. I just want you to feel welcome. So that's appreciated. But, you know, those two churches in all outward appearances are almost identical, but had very, very different reactions. Same thing. But I think a personal connection made all the difference the second time around.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, again, there'll be... This stuff is... I mean, it's going to be... And if we share this, I'm already dreading some of the comments, but.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sure I'll get more of it than you.
It's easy to, well, it's easy. Well, you see, I, as a pastor, in a sense, I also have a responsibility to protect the flock, to hold the line. I am often, but every now and then, because the comment section is extremely generous, and I do read many of the comments, I can't read them all. When it comes to dealing with real people and individuals and relationships, there are varieties of hierarchies and values on hierarchies that are very much at play. Because on one hand, theologically, you could say, yeah, in the Trinity, this dude's a heretic. On the other hand, okay, he's an image bearer of God. and how are we, and the goal of the church, you know, and you're fully aware of it, the goal of the pastor and the goal of the church is for you to give up this biblical Unitarian nonsense and, say the Athanasian Creed along with everybody else for, although it's probably never recited in your evangelical church.
No. No, and I think a lot of people, if they were to be asked to recite it, would be like, what in the world?
So, yeah, they'd be a little shocked at what's in the Athanasian Creed.
Yeah.
So it's a live thing, and I think, as I said in the first thing, it's a fair point that, you know, I made the first time that, well, the church is holding their line, but you're also holding yours. In that, I mean, you're not telling the church you have to come to my side and believe in this way about Jesus, but you are saying I'm not ready to subscribe to the Trinity as such.
Yeah. Or I think I'm right and I think you're wrong.
Right.
Yeah. Which is, I don't put it like that, but...
But that's the truth.
That's the truth, yeah.
Yeah.
There's at least some part of me that wants that to become more widely believed, just the same way everyone wants their thing that they think is true to become more widely believed.
Yeah.
So I do sometimes wonder if I'm doing the right thing by going to these churches at all.
Yeah.
That crosses my mind. But I'm a person. But this is only one question in my mind when I'm choosing how to go to church, how to be involved. It's just sometimes it's dormant, and then sometimes it's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and again, back to the immunity analogy, the built-in resistance to smallpox may be in me as a Northern European, which for how many generations is dormant, and then suddenly someone weaponizes smallpox and somehow many Northern Europeans make the cut because they had immunity built in, you know, centuries ago. So it's a very interesting, and again, I have the comfort of the fact that you live in Chicago and not Sacramento and you didn't show up at my church, and then I have to deal with it. Because it's like, well, how am I going to love Sam and his wife and his child? Because, you know, obviously, I mean, these things get complicated. So, well, why doesn't, you know, let's say you continued to go to the other church and you didn't take communion and your wife did, and then you're there with your daughter, and why doesn't daddy take communion? And now, in a sense, a whole world opens up to your daughter that, okay, honey, let me talk to you about essence and substance and person. And here's Nathan Jacobs. Let's listen to his video when he lays out all the pieces. You know, no five-year-old is going to do that. So, and you get into the question of, are we, you know, do we qualify for something with God by virtue of the correctness of our theology? Then you'd have to have the question, well, how much of our theology has to be correct? Or is it, am I in submission to the teaching of the church? You'll find that obviously much more routinely taught in a Catholic or Orthodox or in another denominational setting, whereas out there in suburban America, you have vast numbers of churches that are non-denominational, but, you know, okay, you're non-denominational. You have this funny thing that you put on the website that you copied and pasted from the other non-denominational down the street, or maybe it's the seminary that you went to, and are you dispensational, or, you know, how many Calvinists are you? And,
yeah. Yeah, I think about that a lot. Like, one question that we sort of talked about last time is there a difference between what we're talking about when we say we believe in God, right? Which is the whole big question that you and a lot of the other YouTubers that you're connected with are talking about. And you often use that falling in love analogy, which I like a lot. That it's something sort of that comes over you. right? To have faith. It's the gift that gets given, and I'll be at least that Calvinist. But is believing in specific doctrines that same sort of thing? It doesn't quite seem like it, right? It seems like that is somewhere more. You had that video about Pascal the other day, the spirit of geometry, or sometimes seems to take over. The spirit of finesse seems to be more at that level of believing in God. But once we've got that kind of basic superstructure, you know, well, premillennial, postmillennial, you know, which, how many points of Calvinism, that seems more geometric-like. Yeah, and it doesn't seem like we're using the same kind of word for belief when we're reciting a creed. When we say, well, I believe in God, or I believe Jesus is my savior, or what have you.
Except that, you know, even the Apostles' Creed, very Trinitarian in terms of the layout, but someone might look at that, you know, And
I like the Apostles' Creed. I'll say the Apostles' Creed all day long, but...
And I know many churches that have the Apostles' Creed as their doctrinal statement. And then if you would walk in and say, oh yeah, I'll subscribe to the Apostles' Creed, but I don't subscribe...
No Nicene Creed. No Nicene Creed. No Athanasian Creed, right?
Oh, certainly no Athanasian Creed.
Certainly not that one.
Yeah. And, oh my, Sam. Oh, wow. Well, I want to talk to you again sometime, and because I'm, you know, it'll be interesting to see how, you know, especially if something changes in your mind, because I suspect, but I'm not going to in this moment try to, you know, engage you. There's probably someone out there who's going to want to say, okay, Sam, you and me, let's debate. But part of the problem
He hasn't talked to me yet. I'll sort him out.
That's right. But part of my problem with debate is psychological, because once, in a sense, you set up the conversation in that way.
Then there's the status element and all the other elements. Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
And one thing I really appreciate getting to talk to you is that just doesn't come up, that the you just have an openness and a kindness for sort of the conversations that's very hard to find. So I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I hope it doesn't get me excommunicated.
I would not want to bring any harm to you or what's happening here on your channel in any way.
Well, and I don't want you to get in trouble with your in-laws either.
Yeah, well.
Well, we'll do like we did last time. I will send you this video and you and your wife can watch it and decide. I mean, your situation is so interesting, and you have a good heart about it, and you have openness and can talk, and also because you're conservative in so many other ways, that puts other Christians that are in evangelical churches, that puts them in a real bind, because if you had some other weirdness out, oh, you have two wives? Well, you know, we don't have to talk about the Trinity thing because you have two wives, out you go. But, I think your pastor, you know, I would, if I were, boy, you know, we had in our cluster of church plants, you know, we've had some pretty interesting conversations lately about, you know, so we've got people coming into, so when you have a church plant, you tend to bring in people from a bigger area. So then you have, okay, communion. Well, who is welcome at the table? And the Christian Reformed Church has had a big conversation about children at the Lord's Supper. And so the CRC did some changes about that, because basically they went back to the Bible and said, it's really hard to bar children from the Lord's Supper if they've been baptized. And of course the Christian Reformed Church has infant baptism. So, but then there's all these other traditions. And so, but then in this crazy patchwork of things out there, you have people coming to the church and say, well, I don't want to baptize my child because I don't want to choose for them, but I want them to partake of the Lord's Supper. So then you have unbaptized children, parents who want their unbaptized children partaking at the Lord's Supper. They're happy to, in a sense, lead their children to the table, but they don't want to bring their children to the baptismal font. And again, now suddenly these issues of the Reformation, issues of the ancient church, church planters are like, ooh. And it would be easy to take a doctrine and say, well, here are the lines. You don't fit in the line, but these, you know, you're also dealing with people on a journey and saying, what we'd really like you to do is to baptize your children. And, you know, we'd like you to do it in this order, but so there.
How much force are you willing to put behind that?
Right. And I have a great deal of respect, well, for the Orthodox, because hey, it's clear you're not getting to that table until you have passed through all the hoops and we have made a decision. So I really respect that. And I think a lot of people do respect that. However, there are many for whom that process might keep them from hearing the gospel regularly, being under the influence of Christian teaching, being, you know, able to be within the target, as Neil Planninga says, of the means of grace. And so, whereas I mean,
how many people have you known who got baptized the same day that they had their, you know, religious conversion? A lot. And where would we be without all those people and all of their children and all the people they witnessed to, et cetera?
That's exactly right. So I went to there was a little tiny little meetup in the Bay Area that invited me to go there. One guy, you know, all the Jordan Peterson people, one guy got baptized the same day. He basically stood up in church and said, I believe, whoosh, right in the water. All right, there you go. Second guy reconnecting to the Roman Catholic Church that he was raised in. Third guy starting the catechumen process to become Orthodox. He eventually joined an Eastern Rite Roman Catholic Church. But, you know, and it's just one thing you learn as a pastor is that people in ministry are messy. And you have to make decisions based on not only, it's so complicated. So
complicated, yeah.
And yeah, people like you are, you know, on one hand, you're a nuisance because doggone it, you caused all those people trouble. On the other hand, what you also force churches and elders and pastors to do is to sit down and revisit these questions.
Yeah.
And to do the theology for themselves and to think through these issues for themselves. And I think that actually, in the long run, strengthens the church.
Yeah. Some people appreciate that forced thinking more than others.
Yes, indeed. Well,
people don't like being poked in their axioms.
That's exactly right. Well, as long as you're safely in Chicago, it's easier on me, unless we post
right.
Then I get into trouble because I was too nice to you, which we're in a very nice age of the church. And that's part of it too. Churches are a little bit desperate. And boy, here comes a guy who's on many measures could be just the kind of church member you want. Except, doggone it, why'd you grow up in that crazy little church that believes those heterodox things? But at the same time, part of the DNA, so what happens when you have a heterodox church like the one you grew up in, there's lots of other, just like you said, there's lots of other things that got bound pretty strongly in you that the churches you are going to now would be blessed by and affirm and appreciate, partly because you were a tiny little group trying to hold on to a minority position with respect to a very settled piece of church doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know that that's part of what's made me who I am, is the like, one thing that a lot of biblical Unitarians often relate to in the Bible is the persecution narrative. Yeah. Sometimes they might overplay that a little bit, but a lot of times they're not, you know. They say, you know, when secular people want something to persecute, they persecute Christians. When Christians want someone to persecute, they persecute biblical Unitarians. So, you know.
Or Mormons.
Or Mormons, yeah.
You know, the LDS church, I mean, out west here, I didn't have any inkling of that when I lived out east. I came out west, and it's like, oh, we've got all these Mormons to think about. And, okay, you've got this biblical Unitarianism. They've got more than one Bible. And right. And they've also got a tradition of, well, you know, a prophet could come up at one point and radically rewrite the doctrines of the church. For right. worse, according to Christians who are looking at it. Richard Mao, who is a very prominent member of the Christian Reformed Church, former philosophy professor at Calvin College, former president of Fuller Seminary. I mean, he's been doing a lot of reaching out to LDS scholars and conversations about theology. You know, he gets crap from people sometimes about that. But I guess Rich Mao and I are on the same page in terms of this, that, hey, we're better talking about this stuff and working through the hard issues.
Yeah, yeah. Amen.
Amen. Well, thank you, Sam. This has been fun, and I will send this to you, and you and your wife can look at it, and then I'm going to have to think about it. You know, is this going to get me in trouble? And
sure.
And then we'll decide what to do. But I do appreciate your spirit and talking to you, and even just your case, which I brought up to Nathan Jacobs, because it was like,
I heard that too. Yeah. Either there's more than one of these, or that's me.
It was you. So again, thank you for your time, and we'll be in touch.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Sam. Take care.